Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is entitled The Body Tells the Tale with very special guests, Dr. Bill Bass and John Jefferson. So now, here's your hosts of today's show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome to the show, everybody. And we did title this, The Body Tells the Tale, and both Jan and I are on, and we'll be discussing some of the ins and outs of forensic anthropology and dead bodies and what happens to folks after they die. And we have two very special guests. Jan and I have been looking forward to this interview for some time. Dr. Bill Bass is an international treasure for his research. And he trained at the University of Virginia in psychology, but got smart and switched to anthropology. Well, you're talking about two ends of the scientific spectrum. I love that. And then got his master's degree and PhD later. He has been a teacher for many, many years and has been honored by more people than you can think of. And, of course, his work was the spinoff for the TV show Bones. John Jefferson is a journalist, a writer, and a documentary filmmaker. He's been published in everywhere from the New York Times to USA Today and Popular Science. He's been on NPR and has produced a couple of very highly rated National Geographic documentaries on the Body Farm. And together they write fiction under the name Jefferson Bass, and we're going to talk a little bit about their fiction writing careers. So, Dr. Bass and John, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And this is Bill Bass, and thank you also.
Yeah, well, we're just delighted to have you here. Obviously, everybody knows has heard the term the body farm. I mean, even Patricia Cornwell wrote a book titled that. It's the University of Tennessee Anthropological Research Facility. When you first conceived of this idea, how did that come about, and what scientific inquiry did you want to answer at the end of the day? Where did you see the hole in knowledge, and where did you expect this to go, this research?
Doug, I've got to go back before coming to Tennessee. I taught for 11 years at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. I identified skeletal material for law enforcement agents there, especially the Kansas Bureau of Investigation. And in the late 60s, I came to Tennessee June the 1st of 71, but in the late 60s, they were having trouble with cattle rustling in western Kansas. If you watch western movies, you know, the bad guys will herd up the cows and drive them over the hill, they're gone. But today, they don't do that. Today, the bad guys either own or rent a refrigerated truck, and they will go out on these large ranches in western Kansas or Oklahoma, Texas, Colorado, and they will kill the cows and butcher them in the field and hang the meat up in the trunk and drive off. The rancher comes along a week or two or 3 weeks later and finds all these dead cow carcasses lying around. And the question then for law enforcement becomes, how long have these cow carcasses been there? The reason for this is this tells law enforcement where in the sale of the meat they need to look. I received a letter from Harold Nye, who at that time was director of the Kansas Bureau Investigation, asking me if I could look at a cow carcass and tell how long it had been dead. And I looked in the literature and found there really wasn't much in there. In fact, there wasn't anything in there, to be honest with you. And I wrote Harold a letter saying, Harold, we don't know this, but if you could find a rancher who would kill a cow, I will look at it every day to find out what happens. And then I sign my name. And then it's interesting, you're thinking about things you don't realize you're thinking about. I put a P.S. on that letter, and I said, Harold, I really need for the rancher to give us four cows. I need one spring, one summer, one fall, and one winter, because your major factor in decay is temperature. Nothing happened to that. That was not very fruitful. And it, by 1971, I had been invited to come to the University of Tennessee to take over an undergraduate anthropology program and build it into a graduate program. And I had met Jerry Francisco, who was the medical examiner here in Tennessee at that time, through the American Academy for Forensic Sciences. And I wrote Jerry and said, Jerry, I'm coming to Tennessee to teach at the University of Tennessee. And he wrote back immediately and wanted to know if I would serve on the medical examiner staff to identify skeletal remains. And it wasn't long before maggot-covered bodies began to come in. And the police asked you two questions, essentially. Not only who is it, but how long have they been there? And I didn't know anything about how long they had been there, and I thought, you know, if I'm going to be talking to police, I better know what I'm talking about. And in the fall of 71, I went to the dean, and I said, Dean, I need some land to put dead bodies on. And everybody said, what did he say? Well, he didn't say anything. He picked up the phone book for the University of Tennessee, and this was the beginning of the body farm. Now, I will stop at that stage and see if you have something you want to ask me specifically.
Yeah, that's an amazing story.
I have to say that I have wondered, you know, what it would be like to walk into the administration of a university in the early 70s and pitch the idea of setting up a place where you would be studying taphonomy, but of course all most people would be thinking about is you're going to do what? So I'm just wondering if even if the dean was understanding, were there obstacles you had to overcome in order to set that up?
The dean was very understanding, yes. He had been head of the physics department and became the dean of the college and was a very thoughtful individual. And he was a great supporter of anthropology, and I think he decided that I was a fairly good guy and knew what I was doing. So I have never had any trouble at all from the university administration. I mean, they have been great supporters of this research.
Hmm. That's great. And were the community accepting the surrounding area when they found out what you were up to out there?
Yes, essentially. The only
there's a story behind that, essentially.
You shouldn't ask a faculty member a question. He's got to go back and discover the wheel and then go on from there. We have a group here in Knoxville called SICK, which is Solutions to Issues of Concern to Knoxvillians. It's a blue collar group that has been told, if you bitch, people jump. And so the head of SICK, when we first started this, was a woman whose son ran a road scraper, not necessarily a bulldozer, but a scraper to scrape down land. And the university had given me some land back of the University of Tennessee Hospital, or gave me 3 acres. And I went, that's what we started on. And I went out there one day, and these all these survey stakes all over the place. And I wonder what's going on. So I started checking and found out that the University of Tennessee Hospital needed more parking space for the staff. And so what they had done, they had taken the land next to the land that had been given to me. Well, I went and said something about it, but they didn't worry about it. But anyway, one of the guys driving the scrapers to scrape down the land to build a parking lot was the son of the woman in charge of SICK. And she thought this was something that they should complain about. And so they held us news conference and had this big sign, "This makes me sick," which I thought was really kind of funny. but nothing ever came of that. I mean, it was a one-day show, and I was well enough known, and it was for the medical examiner staff, and so nothing ever happened to that.
Well, it's really interesting, too. If you talk to people in and around Knoxville, the Body Farm is now such a part of local legend and local lore that people love the Body Farm. People are so proud of the Body Farm. They know that this place has revolutionized forensic science around the world, and they're thrilled about that. And, you know, and Bill Bass is a folk hero in East Tennessee.
Not just in East Tennessee. He's probably trained I think half the forensic anthropologists in the country, and of course the contribution to what we know about taphonomy has been tremendously changed. But in fact, I was wondering, Dr. Bass, what you think of the. I know there are now some imitators, right? There are other similar facilities being set up. I know there's at least one in Texas, and I believe some others in the Eastern Seaboard, if I remember right. So, what have you thought of these imitators?
Well, I think it's good. Your major factor in decay is temperature and the climate in which you have a dead body. And not all the world has a climate like East Tennessee does. I, for years, went out and lectured to try to get Body Farm started. Wasn't very successful, but since I've retired, there have been a number of them that have gotten started. In fact, there are two in Texas. There's one at Baylor, and there's one at Texas State University in San Marcos. The San Marcos one is run by two of our doctoral students who were there. John Williams has one in Cullowhee, North Carolina, which is just on the other side of the mountain from us. So it doesn't look at the climatic conditions. The difference between ours and the one in Western North Carolina is not very great. But, you know, we really need one in, say, Tucson, Arizona, because you have low desert. We need one in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which would be high desert. All of these factors are the major factors in the decay rate and what happens to a dead body.
Very good. Well, it's interesting. One of the most common questions that I get from writers, they'll send me a question that goes something like, well, I have this person that is killed and they're thrown into a body of water, and what will they look like after 3 weeks? Well, you know, where's this body of water? What time of the year is it? That kind of thing. So I know one of the things you do there, you talk about the various locales and how the climate varies, obviously, from different parts of the country, different parts of the world. But there on the Body Farm, you actually create various scenarios like shade, sunlight, underneath things, car trunk, stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about that and some of the unusual things you've discovered there?
Well, what we tried to do with this one was, since we were really doing this for the medical examiner in Tennessee, we tried to recreate the various scenarios in which bodies had been found in Tennessee, and so you have all of those factors. They all, you know, sunlight or shade or in the trunks of cars or inside of automobiles and things like this, all of these things occur, and what we were trying to do is to reproduce as many of those as we could. And essentially, we started off, there was very little literature dealing with this, and we simply started off by looking at how long does it take the right arm to fall off approach. Well, there are a lot of things. I mean, does the right arm have clothing or no clothing? You know, is it, there's all of these things that that really after 42 years of looking at dead bodies, people think I'm an expert, but there's so many things I still don't know that I think all we've done is really scratch the surface.
Well, you mentioned obviously temperature as being the major rate limiting thing here in decay, bacterial growth and that kind of thing. What other things would you consider the most important situational environmental things other than temperature that would affect the rate of decay or process of decay of a corpse?
Well, one of the things that we really don't know much about, and that I've noticed just if you have an individual who has had cancer and has gone through chemotherapy, that body smells differently from a body who has not had chemotherapy. And we have really not looked at what does chemotherapy change that rate of decay? If so, how? What changes in the situation? Those are the things that we are kind of looking at now to see if we can get a better feel if you're on drugs. What does drugs do? We do know that maggots, if you have an individual who has died on drugs and you have maggots, if the maggots are eating on the body, you can, you know, grind up the maggots and find out what the individual was, what drugs they were taking. But we haven't looked at whether this changes the rate of decay or not.
Another really big factor, which, you know, just as a frequent visitor to the body farm, I can mention, is access of insects to the body. If the blowflies can't get to the body, that slows the decay rate down tremendously. Do you want to talk some about that, Bill?
Well, we can. The major factors in decay are the critters, and the first of the critters to be attracted to decaying bodies are the blowflies. The blowflies are the green and blue iridescent flies, and they will lay their eggs, and the eggs hatch into maggots. And the maggots then will begin to destroy the soft tissue. One thing that we have noticed and found out is that maggots can't get through the epidermal layer of the skin, so that if you have differential decay, let's say you find a body and the right hand is down the bone and the left hand still has fingerprints on it, that's your little red flag. You need to look at that, because what this tells you is that individual, when they were killed, let's say they were stabbed, they saw they were going to be stabbed, they held up their right hand, that hand was cut. And this then allows the maggots to get through the epidermal layer into the underlying dermis, into the muscles and things like this. And so when you find a skeleton or a body, decaying body, and one hand is bone and the other hand still has fingerprints on it, those are the things that's telling you that you need to look at that hand that is down to bone, because there'll be a bludgeon or a cut or something like that on the bone.
So you would suspect an open wound, which is a place for the flies to lay their eggs, like the eyes, the nose, and things like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Normally the blowflies are interested in the moist orifices of the body, the eyes, the nose, the mouth, and, again, any wound in the body.
Right.
You know, I was just thinking about a presentation at the last Academy meetings. There was talk about the differences between individuals in terms of just microbial life, sort of at the level of microbes that we each have, sort of our individual sort of microbial fingerprint. Are you seeing any variation, say, between individuals that might be accounted for in that way, or in some other way in which, say, the conclusions you come to have to sort of consider those types of individual variances? Or are there other factors, even, say, something more easily seen, like, say, weight or age that may affect decay and how the body changes?
You are you're right on the edge of science right now. You have asked a question that we need to look at. I'm not sure that we have. These are, when you ask questions like that, we've gotten past the stage that, okay, is it sun or shade and so forth. And these are the things that I think the next generation of forensic anthropologists and people who are interested in decay rate are going to be studying.
Interesting. Do you use, do you do any high-tech stuff like, you know, the artificial nose, gas chromatography and all that, and sampling the air around decay, like closed trunk? You know, the Casey Anthony case obviously involved that to some extent, right, wrong, or indifferent. But are you doing that type of stuff, or is it more anatomical and when you're doing your research?
As a matter of fact, the very first of that research was done here. One of my doctoral students is a man named Arpad Vass. It's V-A-S-S, and he works over at Oak Ridge. And he looked, instead of looking at the body that I look at, looking at the decay of the tissue, he looked at the soil underneath the body. As the body decays and the cells break open and the fluids inside the cells are called the volatile fatty acids, and as the volatile fatty acids leach out of the body, they will stain the carpet under the body or if the body is outside, they will kill the vegetation right under the body. And what he did was he looked at the samples. He sampled the soil. Volatile fatty acids, there are lots of those. The names like putrescine and cadaverine, each one of those is a different one. And they have different half-lives and what he has done, his doctoral dissertation was to set up, is to take a soil sample, look at about 25 of the volatile fatty acids, and he set up a scale that if you have a soil sample within the first 2 years of death, it was a doctoral dissertation, so he didn't go past 2 years. He had a pretty good indicator of how long that body had been there.
It's interesting. You know, he looks at the ratio of those chemicals.
Right.
You know, and as the decomposition progresses, the ratio of chemicals changes. So he's able to look at if he sees a certain ratio of chemicals, he's able to correlate that with his research because what he did is he pulled vapors off of bodies that he'd buried for years. He pulled vapors off these bodies and analyze the ratios of the chemicals, you know, at frequent intervals so that he can match a specific ratio that he finds in the field to all these all the research data that he's gathered over years, and he can tell you how long that body has been decomposing and giving off those particular chemicals. It's really quite astonishing.
He can even do that without the body.
He can't.
If somebody's come and moved the body after it's decayed.
Well, one of the things that I have tried to teach the police, many times, this is not something that occurs just occasionally, but it's something that occurs all the time, is that after the blowflies get there, it isn't long before the canids, the dogs, the coyotes, if you live in an area where there are bears, and the bears in East Tennessee, they're all frequent decaying bodies. And you don't realize you have a decaying body out there until a dog brings in a hand or a mandible or something like that into the yard. And then, you know, then you've got that, okay, where is it, and so forth. And we haven't done much on that because that's really complicated. A dog normally does not go more than about a half a mile from the house. But if you put a dot on the paper and you go a half a mile up from that dot and draw a circle, there's a lot of land in that amount of area. But I tell the police, if you wonder where that body originally lay, you can look for the volatile fatty acid stain This is the stain that the volatile fatty acids had killed the vegetation. And in Tennessee, it takes about 2 years for that stain, for nature to reclaim that area. So you have, I mean, if you have a body that's been dead a year, you can, if it's been spread around by animals, which it probably has, you can find where it originally lay by looking for that volatile fatty acid stain.
It's a dark, greasy stain. It almost looks like the vegetation has been burned. Except that it hasn't. It's simply been killed by the acidity.
Fascinating stuff. We're going to take a brief break here, and then we will be back with Dr. Bill Bass and John Jefferson, and we will explore dead bodies a little further.
You hear? about you anymore.
So welcome back out to the break, everybody, here again on Shrine and Science Radio with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. And again, the body tells the tale with very special guests, Dr. Bill Bass and John Jefferson. And again, here's your host, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everybody. We've been having a great discussion here. I hope you've all enjoyed the first half of this show. I have. I've learned a lot already. And one question I want to ask, when you've been studying these corpses for all these years and doing your taphonomy, the study of the science of decay, what have you uncovered that you did not expect to uncover or that surprised you the most about this process? Something that you said, wow, I didn't know that would happen. Anything like that ever pop up?
Well, remember when we first started 42 years ago, we really didn't know anything at all, essentially, about what would happen. And it is interesting to see that there is a pattern. And if you know what the variables are, you can, from the pattern, you can estimate fairly accurately the length of time since death. It's not a haphazard type of situation. It's just having somebody sit down and look at these things. They're not the most appetizing things to look at, but to record all this and begin to see what the pattern is.
So as you were doing this, you mentioned that you were working with the medical examiner's office there, but I would assume other law enforcement agencies or and possibly the FBI took an interest in what you were doing. Have you worked with other agencies beyond those in your local area?
Oh, yes. This will be the sixth or seventh year, I think. We have offered a week-long course for FBI evidence response team members. They come and spend a week in March with us every year, and we bury five bodies, and we scatter some bones out on the hillside, and then we have had the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation agents come. The Knox County, Knoxville, Tennessee is in Knox County. We have the Knox County Sheriff's Office comes every year. So we do. We have two or three groups from Kentucky that come every year.
Also DMORT, the Disaster Mortuary Operational Response Teams. Mm-hmm. They do a mass disaster training every year using corpses from the body farm.
Right, we should probably mention, in case our listeners aren't aware of what a DMORT team is, someone realized some years ago that you could plan all you wanted for what would happen in a mass disaster, but if you didn't figure out what you were going to do with the fatalities, with the bodies, that you were going to have trouble. So they set up a system for dealing with mass fatality situations. So yeah, that was, and that's one of the things I think it's sort of, as you mentioned, Dr. Bass, of setting this up 42 years ago, it's sometimes kind of surprising, maybe our avoidance of death, we don't always think about these things should have been, maybe part of scientific study going back, but it kind of gets avoided somehow.
That's one of those things that, why didn't somebody think about this earlier? I'm glad you thought of it when you did, but you just
exactly.
Always ask the question, why didn't somebody think of this 80 years ago?
Well, let me tell you that week, when John Jefferson approached me, it's been 10, 12 years ago now. John was working at Oak Ridge at the Atomic Energy Facility over there as a science writer, and John called and wanted to know if he could do a two-hour video documentary for the body farm. And I said, sure. And John comes over, and we begin to look at at things. And I, the students, I had just retired at that time. And the students asked me when I was going to write a popular book. Well, I'm not good at writing a popular book, but I talked to John. And John and I decided we would do that. And we wrote the first book, which was a nonfiction book based on my career with police-based and so forth. And then John wanted to try his hand at some fictional books. And so the series of fictional books we've done have been because what we've done is John has come up with a story and I've done the science. And that's how we got started. You don't have many science writers in which you have two authors doing those things.
Well, especially not one a scientist and one a writer. I mean, that's an unusual combination.
Now, we were interested in finding out about that from the two of you. I know Doug and I have each, of course, done research with forensic scientists, and I think Doug probably finds the same thing I do. You get very excited when you connect up with somebody who can understand what you're trying to do and who doesn't come from a point of saying, well, what are the facts? And you're saying, well, the facts are from whatever might make the scene interesting, throws people for a loop.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as a, you know, as somebody who started out in literature and has spent a lot of time hanging out in the world of science, you know, I like you guys, I see things on television that just make me cringe and roll my eyes, and I know that if even I know enough to know how terrible that stuff is, that, you know, that people who are, you know, other people who are forensic experts or scientific experts must just be absolutely appalled.
Oh, yeah. Well, how do you guys work together? What's your mechanism for doing things? I know, you know, you go back to Bernie Taupin and Elton John. Bernie would write the lyrics and send them to Elton. He'd put them to music. But when you're working your stories out and plotting them and outlining them or whatever you do, and then when you get together with the writing, how do you work together on that?
John, you want to take that?
Sure. Well, one of the things we do early on is we're developing a plot is we think about what forensic techniques we'd like to kind of showcase or highlight in that book, something maybe that we haven't really focused on before. So in one of the books, we have multiple bodies that are burned, and, you know, we talk about the effects of fire on flesh and bone and how you identify burned victims who are burned to varying degrees. You know, in some skeletal trauma, sharp trauma, or blunt force trauma might be the forensic issue that's highlighted. In our latest book, Cut to the Bone, there's both saw marks in bone. That's one of the distinctive identifiers in a couple of cases that come up in Cut to the Bone. And then the hyoid bone and its role in revealing strangulation as a cause of death features pretty prominently as well.
So you had, I think, started this book is a little different from the others in the series in that it's a prequel, right, to the other stories?
Yeah, that's right. The other books, so the first seven books in the fiction series and the Body Farm novels, have been essentially set in the present moment or the present day. So the first novel came out in 2006 and was set in 2006. And so that's been the case for 7 years. Now, suddenly in the 2013 novel, Cut to the Bone, we go back in time by two decades to the year 1992, where our readers can see our hero, Dr. Bill Brockton, as they have never seen him before, which is relatively young. You know, he's in his late 30s in this book. He's just come to the University of Tennessee. He's really just kind of finding his path, or you might even say his destiny there. He creates the Body Farm in this book, Cut to the Bone, And so it's, although it's the eighth book in the series, it actually reads as if it were the first book in the series because it is a prequel to all the others.
And is there a, if I remember seeing you on your website, there's like a novella, is it, that's out now?
Yeah, the novel, Cut to the Bone, came out in late September. The prequel, which is called Jordan Stormy Banks, it's much shorter. It's only about, I think, 50 or 60 pages. It came out at the very beginning of September. And it's, in fact, a pre-prequel. It's a prequel to the prequel. It's set in the year 1990, and our hero, Bill Brockton, has literally only been at the university for a few months at the time that that book is set. So he really, it's the essentially the first real case and almost his last case at the University of Tennessee, because he very nearly meets a premature end.
So this makes me think, Dr. Bass, given the amount of time that the actual Body Farm has been around, as I understand, the bodies are most of them donated by individuals who sign on to have their bodies used in this way?
That's correct. When we first started, remember I was a member of the medical examiner staff. And the bodies came through the medical examiner system. These were bodies that were unclaimed that were in the medical examiner system. And up until 2003, the most bodies that came in any one year were bodies that came through the medical examiner system. But starting in 2003, many people knew about the Body Farm and knew that we would accept donations. And starting in 2003, and every year since then, the most bodies we've gotten have come from people who have willed their bodies or donated their bodies to the anthropology department at the University of Tennessee. Last year, we did 148 bodies. So we're doing essentially about a body every 2 days. Now, the ultimate of all of those is we're building up a collection of modern skeletal remains. Mm-hmm. So all the bones of those individuals are kept, they are cleaned, they are numbered, and they are stored for any individual who wants to come and look at them. It's an excellent collection of the modern population.
Which I guess there's a shortage right now of skeletons for teaching purposes, aren't there in the U.S.? Or,
I think this occurred in 1985. The Indian government put a moratorium on the shipping of bodies from India to biological supply houses in the United States. And mm-hmm. so up until about 85, you could buy a skeleton through biological supply houses. If they were mounted, they were more expensive because it takes a lot of work to mount all the 206 bones in an adult skeleton. But
let me ask you this. How big is the facility right now? And if we went there, how many bodies would be in place at any one time?
Well,
roughly.
I will answer that by telling you there are probably 70 or 80 out there right now.
Okay.
But it would depend on the time of the year. Most of the research is done out there, either master's thesis or doctoral dissertations. And there would be more there in the summer when the students aren't there than there are in the winter and things like this. So it would depend on how many students are doing research and things like that. But
sure.
There would be, you're talking 60 to 80 maybe at any one time. We have cleanup parties throughout the year in which we go out and we try not to leave a body out there longer than a year. If there's research that you want to go longer than that, they can. But if you leave them there longer than a year, then they begin to get longitudinal cracks from the sun,
right.
Where the side facing the sun dries more so than the underside, and so you begin to get damage to the skeletal material, and we try not to do that.
And it's also easy to lose little bones, finger bones, and foot bones to small scavengers that can get into the facility.
Sure.
Do you have room for more donors, or if people are interested, is it still possible to donate, or are you full?
Yeah, well, no, we are.
We'll
the
save you
staff.
A spot, Dan.
I have an anthropologist friend who's doing something like this, and she wants her epitaph to read, "You haven't seen the last of me."
Okay. We are now taking only individuals who have filled out the forms that have pre-registered, if you want to say that, who have filled out the forms to donate their bodies. Anybody that's done that, we will take their body. But if you die and just call us on the phone, we're at the stage now where we normally don't do that.
If you die and call them on the phone, you're going to make some headlines.
Well, if you have family that calls you.
Well, let me ask you each this, and it's from two different points of view. But, Dr. Bass, for you, what do you see down the road and what major questions are unanswered? And, well, let's get that first. What do you see coming down the road?
Well, we're beginning to do some research now on the location, the location of buried bodies.
Right.
The best procedure now is to use a cadaver dog. We really don't know what cadaver dogs are smelling. This is going back to Arpad Vance's research previously, but we're also looking at multiple graves. These are the things you're running into in Iraq and Afghanistan and things like that, in the Middle Eastern area. There should be better ways of locating these things than we had in the past, and we're doing some research on that now.
Cool. And, John, from your point of view, coming from the writer side, mm-hmm. and then entering this scientific world, even though you were a science writer before, what have you found to be the most intriguing and fascinating about working with Dr. Bass and working with a body farm and working on these fiction stories together and things like that? What's really got your motor running about all this?
A couple things. One thing is how, every step builds on all the previous steps. There's the light bulb notion of scientific progress, which generally, has some kernel of truth in it, but also most of science is incremental. And just to look at the early photographs and read about the early studies that they did there at the body farm, and then to see how much more sophisticated the research has gotten as they have learned from the previous studies and built on them is really quite astonishing. The work that Arpad Vass has done to be able to read the chemical byproducts of decomposition almost like a stopwatch is just really fascinating. But the other thing is just how I think heroic in some ways the people who do this kind of work are. It's not only not glamorous, it's as far from glamorous as you can get. It's smelly, it's messy, it's often really disturbing, but it's so important in helping solve crimes. The work that's come out of the body farm has been used around the world, and it really has made huge, huge changes in the science of forensics. It's just been such a privilege to me to be part of that. It's I've had this 12-year tutorial You know, with one of the great forensic scientists in the world, and that's just, you know, what a lucky guy I've been.
Well, as you said, this stuff kind of builds on the other's creativity, favors the informed mind.
The
more you
mind.
Know, the more creative you are. But I guess, you know, what I'm hearing from both of you is, just like in the, if you go back through the history of medicine, I'm a big buff of the history of medicine, is that we started out anatomically, and then we went microscopically, and now the field of medicine is biochemically. And that's kind of what you're doing now, moving into the biochemical realm of decay.
I think that's a very good observation, yes. You have, I think, hit the nail on the head there.
Fascinating stuff.
You know, I think one of the other things that I love about forensic anthropology as an outsider, and maybe it's from my own background, the major of dilettantes, I was a history major, but is that there are so many things that forensic anthropology encompasses, and we've kind of hit on some of them here, but that you're not just looking at, yes, there's the medical side of it, but we're looking at entomology, at botany, at zoology, at geology, all of those things as well. And then as you talk to forensic anthropologists working out in the field, they're also looking at everything from clothing and where it might have been made and all sorts of, you know, are these remains historical? Are these remains contemporary? So you're in a field that really covers a tremendous number of specialized areas of information that feed into it.
I think what I have found is you need to know a little bit about a lot of things.
That's true. Well, anyway, how's the new book doing, Cut to the Bone, and what's on the horizon in the literary world?
Well, the new book just got named one of the best of 2013 by Suspense Magazine.
Cool.
So we're excited about that. That's great. You know, it's gotten good reviews. It's doing well. But we can't worry about that anymore because we've got another manuscript to do early in 2014. You know, and you know, since we journeyed back in time and cut to the bone to 1992, we're going to come only partway back to the present, I think, in the next book. We're going to come about 10 years forward, you know, and we'll follow up a little bit with, there'll be some epilogue or you know, carry forward from the prior book into this one. But then, of course, some new, the main plot will be something new, and then we'll lay a little groundwork for the book after that, I think. You know, of course, you know, I'm just making all this up. Very little of this exists on paper at this point, but, you know, fake it till you make it.
Well, as someone who's written prequels, I don't know if you found the same challenge of it. Sometimes it's hard to think yourself back even 10 or 20 years ago because, you know, you suddenly realize, no, there wasn't an iPhone.
Well, you know, interestingly, the main difference, you know, in Cut to the Bone, you know, cell phones are just starting to come into use in the early 90s, and Dr. Brockton doesn't yet have one, and there's a moment or two when it would really have helped him if he did have one in this book. He's kind of, you know, inwardly cursing himself for not having gotten one yet. You know, but he's not what they call an early adopter, apparently. But the main interesting challenge in this book was that in the first book in this series, set in 2006, our hero, Dr. Brockton, has spent 2 years mourning the death of his beloved wife. Well, in 1992, his beloved wife was very much alive and well, and they were quite happy. So it was writing a whole different kind of personal life for Dr. Brockton. His wife is alive and well. They're happy together. Their son is only 16 at this point. So it was a very different family dynamic or personal life dynamic for him at the time. But I found that actually really quite fun. It was so nice for him not to be, you know, alone or sad or, you know, or getting involved in a disastrous relationship that didn't last long, you know, with all those things that happened in books one through seven. It was kind of fun to get to go back and, you know, and see him at that, you know, less scarred period in his life.
Have you found yourself starting to work on something and thinking about something and said, well, wait a minute, that wasn't available then. That wasn't, we couldn't do that then. That wasn't around then. Not just, you know, in life, like cell phones and stuff, but in the scientific world, you have to go back and double check. Well, wait a minute, were we doing that in 1996?
I had some nice resources to draw on, including our first nonfiction book, which is called Death's Acre, which really tracks.
Which is a great book.
Right, Bill Bass's career through a series of cases, you know, more than a dozen cases through the years, and so it was really helpful to be able to refer to cases from the 1990s, the early 90s. So I didn't get into too many of those briars when I was working on this.
Well, I'm going to tell you, gentlemen, this has been an absolute delight, and I know Jan echoes that completely.
Yes, indeed.
It's been wonderful. We've been looking forward to chatting with you, and it's been a great hour and not long enough. And I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's a great show. We're so pleased you guys are doing this.
Well, we're glad to have you and to share your expertise. And as I tell everybody, if you go to the Crime and Science Radio site on Suspense Radio, we'll have links up for further study. My website has the same thing, and Jan and I now have a blog, our website blog. It's called crimeandscienceradio.com, and if you go there, all the shows and links and the little buttons where you can listen to the archives are all there, too. So until next time, thank you. We appreciate you being here on Crime and Science Radio.
Thank you for having us.